My next guest is Rich Lee, head of program and ETF trading at Robert W. Baird, who's an international financial services firm with over $170 billion in client assets. And Rich himself is an expert on all the ins and outs of ETF trading, rebalancing, everything that goes on behind the scenes of ETFs. And interestingly, Baird recently became an authorized participant for ETFs in August of last year. Rich is now joining me via phone from New York. Rich, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Rich, first, just tell us a little bit more about your specific role at Baird, especially as it pertains to ETFs.
Sure. So basically, on the program trading and ETF desk here at Baird, we basically help our customers execute large baskets of stocks or ETFs. And so that could be a fund that's putting money to work across all names in a fund, or they could be doing a redemption or rebalance, or trading ETFs can be part of a program, and they may be looking to do an NAV trade, or they may be looking to have us facilitate a creation or redemption on their behalf. So those are some of the things that we do on our desk, and our overall goal is to basically help our customers source liquidity as best they can.
And then what about the AP role? So that started in August of last year. How did Baird get involved there?
Sure. So, you know, as you think about the ETF ecosystem, you know, authorized participants play an important role in the facilitation and the liquidity and the price discovery process for ETFs, right? So if you think about it from the issuer side, if you're a ETF issuer, you want to have authorized participants that are going to be there and facilitate trading, i.e. creation, redemption of your products, as well as market making, so basically providing liquidity on the screens so that their ETFs can have a robust ecosystem. And then for institutional customers, where authorized participants can come into play, is they can actually help further facilitate that liquidity profile. So for instance, if a institutional customer came to us and said, hey, I would like to buy 250,000 shares of this ETF, but it only trades, say, 100,000 shares a day, if you were to basically just kind of go out, if there were not market makers making a market in that stock or there wasn't deep liquidity in it, for instance, you would probably have non-trivial impact by buying that 250,000 shares of the ETF straight in the marketplace. What you could instead do is look at the underlying baskets on behalf of the customer, buy that basket, and invoke the creation process with the ETF provider and give them the in-kind of 250,000 shares of the ETF, thereby facilitating that transaction, facilitating liquidity in that name or ETF.
Right, and obviously authorized participants, they play a critical role just in helping keep the price of an ETF in line with the value of its underlying assets. I always like to say, you know, this is really where the magic of ETFs happens, which I'm sure you agree with. I guess on that note, can you talk about how Baird approaches this process? Like, is it all algorithmically driven? How competitive is it with other APs? Like how big do the premiums and discounts need to be? Just give us a window into this process.
Sure. So I'll speak directly towards the creation redemption process as opposed to things like market making or arbitrage in the marketplace, right? But with regard to creation redemptions, it's actually a pretty, I don't want to use the word boring, but it's definitely a methodical process-driven approach, right? It's not like you're trading on screens, algos. It basically, in simplest terms, if I were to do a creation, I would log on to a provider website, and I would say, hey, I would like to create 3 units of this ETF. That message gets transmitted to the ETF custodian. They acknowledge that. You would then download what's known as a portfolio composition file, which is the constituents and the weights that make up that respective ETF. And then you would then, at the end of the day, deliver them that basket in that weights, and they would in turn deliver you the ETF in NAV terms. And then the opposite is true for a redemption. So it really is sort of it's more of a clearing function. Now, with regard to if you have to position yourself so that you have the stock to deliver for the ETF and you need to trade and there may be stocks that are a little bit more liquid, that's where we actually employ technology algorithms and liquidity-seeking technology on our desk to find the best price possible for our customers.
Well, and that's what's interesting to me. I mean, there are a lot of variables here, and I'm curious. I mean, can you talk more about, you know, if you're looking at a creation or redemption, you know, how to ensure that that is a profitable endeavor for Baird?
Sure. I think it's a function of having your having straight through operational efficiency, right? There, you know, if you're thinking about a typical ETF transaction, I mean, let's take something as vanilla as the spiders, right? 506 stocks in the S&P 500, 506 stocks that need to be booked and processed. So you want to make sure that you have a high transaction and settlement efficacy rate. You want to minimize manual intervention as much as you can, because that can lead to errors. And you just want to make sure that you have your operational processes tight from a clearing perspective. And then from a trading perspective, you want to make sure that you have technology that's seeking the best price when you have to trade in the market.
Rich, I thought as a way to help listeners better understand the role of an AP, it might be interesting to get your take on some interesting stories that are out in the ETF marketplace right now. And one of the biggest is ARK Invest. Obviously, ARK is a huge success story overall, but you know, their performance has taken a bit of a step back here recently. And there's a lot of debate around how ARK might unwind some of their concentrated positions if their ETFs get hit with redemptions. I think some believe they could enter what's referred to as a doom loop, a negative feedback loop, because they currently own at least 10% of the float for something like 25 to 30 stocks. What insight can you offer here? Like, does that cause you any concerns?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, I actually find, having done this for a while, I find this whole conversation that's happening around the ARK ETFs and other transparent ETFs and this sort of doom loop phenomenon that you referenced kind of interesting, right? Because if you think about what ARK is doing, they've had tremendous success marketing a transparent ETF product, right? But this ETF product allows customers the ability to enter and exit quickly, right, real time, have real time pricing. There's tax efficiencies associated with, you know, having an ETF. But really, if you think about it and take a step back, is it that different from a traditional active money manager that holds a portfolio of stocks, right, whether it be a value-oriented or growth-oriented manager? So from that perspective, you know, I don't see that there's inherently more risk than that corresponding active money manager, right? Now, the fact that they are a ETF and a transparent ETF, I would argue actually allows for greater liquidity and greater facilitation because of some of the things we talked about. You have market makers out there that are providing a two-sided market so that if things start to get dislocated either on the underlying basket side or on the ETF side, ARBs can step in. There's an opportunity there to keep things kind of level. And then, again, with regard to the creation redemption process, the authorized participant, you know, potentially allows the ability to kind of facilitate a creation redemption that, you know, may be a custom basket so that you don't have to necessarily sell out of the most illiquid name, per se, and there's some flexibility there. So I would say that, you know, again, if you look at specifically in this case of the ARK ETF, you're not really looking at anything, or you're not really having a conversation that's that, I think, dramatically different than you would have with a traditional value manager that is managing a fund, right, in terms of positions and what they're doing from an investment perspective. But I will say that you do have the added, I guess, benefit of the ETF wrapper, and with that, you know, the authorized participant.
You mentioned custom baskets. I'm not sure if you saw last week, Dave Nodig over at ETF Trends, he had a fantastic interview with the ARK chief operating officer. And I want to read you a passage from that. So the ARK COO, he said, you know, like being an ETF really helps us. In extreme case, we can do this with a custom basket. And that's probably the part that never gets talked about. If you really get into a situation where you want out of a name, we can work with authorized participants to in-kind out the name we are exiting through custom baskets. People talk about the short interest in some of these names. Sometimes those are names that market makers want to do a custom basket on because they can close a bunch of positions all at once without going into the market and driving the price up by covering their shorts. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And I think he's highlighting what I talked about, right, with regard to the role that the authorized participant can play in the liquidity facilitation process. I'll give a little bit of an example that near and dear to anybody that's been following the retail world lately, GameStop, right? The XRT, which is the retail ETF, has GameStop as a component of that ETF. And at one point during the height of everything that was going on with GameStop, I think there was like something like north of a 60% redemption of XRTs, right? And you could easily see people doing that because they wanted to redeem out of the XRTs, not because there was any sort of, you know, belief in the inherent, you know, value or discount in the price of the XRT, but because they wanted to redeem out of the XRT so that they could receive back the GameStop shares that were part of it, so that maybe they could potentially lend it out or, you know, meet short obligations or, you know, fill a short position. So, you know, that's one way in which people can kind of use the creation redemption process.
Well, and I think what's interesting there is, you know, ETFs have multiple APs associated with them, and those APs all may have differing goals and objectives, to your
That's
point.
Right.
And so, you know, that that can act as another release valve or buffer. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that if you look at mutual funds, if a mutual fund is hit with redemptions, they have one option, right, which is to sell
right.
directly into the market to raise cash. That's it.
That's
the only option. I'm curious, you know, the ARK ETFs, they are actively managed. Are there any differences in how APs hedge risk on an active ETF versus an index ETF, or is it all the same process?
I think, you know, the overall risk management process is the same in terms of, do you have your technology in place? Do you have your systems in place? How are you thinking about risk? How are you looking at sort of, you know, cash positions? How are you looking at correlation of positions that you have? But that said, I think it is a little bit different with a traditional, say, index ETF like the Spiders or, you know, the XLE or the XLK than a transparent or semi-transparent ETF, just because there's a little bit of nuance around the creation redemption process that's not as sort of straightforward as the vanilla creation redemption for a straight indexed ETF product.
You're saying on the semi-transparent side,
yes,
there can be some differences.
What
like what kind of differences would there be in terms of the AP process?
Sure. So for instance, I think that there are currently about five approved semi-transparent structures that are approved, right, for semi-transparent ETFs. So you have firms like Percadian, Blue Tractor, the New York Stock Exchange, and then Fidelity and T. Rowe, which were just approved for their products. And if you think about what makes it transparent is they all have different ways of they are actively managed ETFs, but they have different ways of, I guess, expressing their transparency, right, of their holdings. And I think the goal is obviously rather than something that's fully transparent, which all the holdings and weights are disclosed, the semi-transparent, there's some notion of either weights or names or positions, right? So for instance, you could have, in the case of Percadian, the actual ETF holdings are disclosed daily, but only to an authorized participant representative, right? So
right.
there's an abstraction layer, right? If you look at something like T. Rowe, they're using something like a proxy portfolio that's disclosed daily with at least over 80% overlap between the actual ETF holdings. So there is some sort of component of abstraction involved with how these semi-transparent ETFs are going to market. And that's, you know, by and large to protect, obviously, the provider, right?
Right. Now, and from what I've seen, so I hear you, it sounds like there's more complexity on the back end. The one thing I will say is APs appear to be doing a great job here, because if you look at the spreads on those products that are out in the wild right now, they're pretty tight overall.
Yep.
And comparable to transparent active ETFs. Rich, just a few minutes left. I want to ask you about this BIS, Bank for International Settlements, report on bond ETFs that came out last week. And there was a lot here. I read the whole thing. It was like 15 or 16 pages. But if I had to boil it down, basically the report suggested that bond ETF issuers were handing APs lower quality baskets during the turmoil in March of last year. And I think where the report was heading was that this then left the remaining ETF portfolio at a higher quality, and therefore investors would be less likely to sell. It might also make APs less likely to redeem, which is why bond ETFs were trading at discounts. And so the point was all of this actually functioned as a stabilizing force in the bond market. you essentially had risk transferred to investors who wanted to transact in this environment. Do you agree with that takeaway and any other color you might offer here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think that because of that mechanism, you think of it almost as a safety valve, right? So rather than if there's a panicked period in the marketplace where everybody feels that they want to exit, right, for short-term liquidity constraints, the AP can step in and say, wait a minute, we're going to facilitate this, certainly, but there's ways that we can do this that satisfy liquidity constraints of the end investor that's looking for the liquidity, as well as the ETF provider, right, that is the manager of the ETF and the authorized participant who is going to play a role in facilitating that. And if they can help facilitate that in a way that makes sense for everybody, i.e. The ETF issuer is not forced to sell out of, to your point, lower quality bonds that may be illiquid, right, but the authorized participant can also work with them to deliver in-kind baskets, then I think that's a situation that does help kind of, I don't want to say, it's almost, I guess I would say, is a nice sort of mechanism that sits between and kind of allows for a little bit more flexibility in the marketplace.
One thing that I'll hear from ETF naysayers is this thought that APs might just walk away in distressed markets. And I've always shot that down by just saying, look, money rules everything, right? And I think you were alluding to this earlier. If there's truly an arbitrage profit opportunity, that financial incentive is enough to keep the machinery functioning properly. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting, right? Because that's the argument that you hear time and time again for market makers or market participants in general, right? And I think, you know, the more participants you have in the marketplace, the more people that contribute to the ecosystem, the more players you're going to have that have different incentives and motivations, right? So whereas, you know, I might be looking to liquidate, someone may be looking to sell, right? Or if things get dislocated enough, it kind of wakes buyers up. So you know, absolutely, I think that having a robust ecosystem helps kind of ensure that these products keep trading and keep liquidity on the screens.
Well, Rich, a very insightful conversation this week. This is actually a topic I haven't dug into probably as much as I should. We'll have to do this again. Thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, and I love doing this.
That was Rich Lee, head of program and ETF trading at Robert W. Baird.